Have you ever wondered why a woman planning a natural birth ends up in a surprise C-section? And can you guess the 6 high-risk things being done to pregnant women every day in almost every country that have actually never been tested or proven to be safe and effective? Today, I'm joined by a friend, leader, and pattern disruptor, Dr. Stuart J. Fishbein. He is a community-based obstetrician and an associate of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, published author of the book Fearless Pregnancy, Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom, as well as the author of many peer-reviewed papers. After completing his residency at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, California, Dr. Stu spent 24 years assisting women with hospital birthing and for the last 13 years has been a home birth obstetrician who works directly with midwives. Since retiring from attending home births in 2022, Dr. Stu has turned his focus to traveling the world as a lecturer and an advocate for reteaching breech and twin birth skills, respect for the normalcy of birthing, and honoring informed consent. Thanks for joining me on Born to Know, the podcast that brings you conversations with world-renowned experts and thought leaders in every field to peel back the layers of this epic world we live in and to see where choice really resides for each of us every day. All righty. It is a pleasure and an honor to be hanging out with you today. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Stu.
You're welcome. I'm sorry for laughing, but we've actually been hanging out for about 40 minutes already, working on tech, but we got it settled. So that's why I'm wearing these goofy headphones.
Yeah, right. They say you get to know someone through travel, and I guess now you get to know them through tech. experiences.
That's right. Hi, how are you?
Oh, good, good. Everything is great. And, I feel like we're already at the end of 2024. So much has happened.
That's a very positive thing for you to say as you have a category 4 to 5 hurricane bearing down on your state again. Second one in 10 days?
Second one in 10 days. I trust this process. I treat life like I treat birth. What's meant for me is meant for me. I can take inspired action and the rest, I leave it up to the divine. So that's where I'm at today with this Cat 4 hurricane or Cat 5. We'll see. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, it's autumn, but it's still really nice here. We're in the high 80s at night. I mean, in the daytime and down in the 50s at night. I'm in southern Utah, as people may know, and the weather's been great.
Yeah, and you're about to speak at a conference there? Did I see that?
Oh, there's a couple things going on. There's a local one here in Kanab. I'm speaking at the public library, which is going to be kind of fun for me, small group. And then the Birth Expo is a thing they have annually in St. George for Utah. But I just finished a long speaking tour where I spent 4.5 weeks in Australia. And I taught 6 seminars, 2-day breech seminars to a very receptive group of wonderful birth workers there in Australia. And I learned a lot about what's going on in the world. In Australia is the same as it's going on in a lot of other places with the birth tyranny that's going on. And the midwives who want to help women with their autonomy and decision-making are getting, you know, deregistered and getting, they're fearful and afraid because of Big Brother coming down on them. And the statistics of Big Brother's machinery is terrible. You know, they have 40% C-section rates here, and they have a 13% VBAC success rate here, and they have 30% episiotomy rate here in Australia. And that, so I learned a lot of stuff. And then I spoke at the Convergence of Rebellious Midwives, which was a wonderful gathering put together by Melanie Jackson. And some of my favorite people were there, like Sarah Buckley, and I don't want to leave anybody out, but Kirsten Small and Rhea Dempsey and Hannah Dahlin were all there. And then after touring, my daughter came for a little bit and spent 7 days with me. We rented a car and drove on the wrong side of the road and enjoyed ourselves driving up the Gold Coast, and then ended up in Melbourne, where I got to see the Melbourne birth community. I got to see the penguins come in at night, and we got to pet kangaroos and koala bears. And so it was a great trip. And then from there, I went to Montana and I taught with the Go Midwife group there, which I've done for about 10 years now in Bozeman. And then I went on to, what's that? New faces every time. Pretty much a couple of the old faces are around. And then off to London, Ontario, where I got to speak at the Reclaiming Birth Conference with...
How was that? I got invited.
Gloria LeMay and Billy Harrigan.
So awesome.
It's great, but there's a commonality going on that birth is under attack and our outcomes are awful. And the people that make the outcomes awful think that they should be the ones telling people with good outcomes like midwives how to practice and how to do things. And there's a battle going on and people are going to have to stand up and some people are going to get persecuted for that. I mean, they already have, obviously, like Gloria LeMay going to jail. But if you believe in something, you have to stand up. It's the time to try to collaborate with people who don't want to collaborate with you is over. It's over. And, you know, if our outcomes were good, if babies were healthier than they've ever been, if mothers were happier than they'd ever been, if our C-section rates were closing in on what they were 50 years ago, if our birth trauma rates were in 30 and 40% with these meetings that they're having in the United Kingdom and Australia and even Canada are having these gatherings to talk for women to express themselves about the trauma they've experienced. If those things were all better, you could say, okay, this model works. But this is the definition of insanity, is to take a model that's not working and then say, we're just going to do more of it. So that's what I learned. And my job is to essentially try to keep the skills of breech and twin birthing alive. And I've got a lot of experience with that over the years, both in the hospital. I have that unique perspective, as you know, that I spent 28 years working as a hospital-based doctor, and then a little over 12 and a half years as a home doctor. And so I have this unique perspective of how things go in both worlds. And most of the time, those two worlds are like siloed. They never meet. And the doctors in the hospital don't pay much attention to what goes on at home other than they think it's awful. Never, by the way, having no self-reflection and looking in the mirror and seeing how their statistics in their hospital are doing. And then we have hospital midwives who are sometimes overzealous about their condemnation of the hospital system. And we have to find a way to work together, but ultimately that's not the way it works. What's happening is the golden rule, but not the one that you and I grew up with. It's the golden rule is them that has the gold makes the rules. And right now the medical model is delivering in my country, 98.5% of women are delivering in the hospital. And you can't blame the horrible, you know, what I think are terrible statistics and outcomes on the fact that 1% of women are giving birth at home. And yet that seems to be the focus because no one wants to be, self-reflection is not one of their strong points.
No, it's not. And I mean, this is actually a question I was going to say for later in the conversation, but we're diving in now. And I come into contact with so many women and couples who start out with the perception that birth is safer in the hospital. They perceive the hospital as a place where death can be prevented, right? But they don't consider that although there are the resources to prevent death, there are a lot of interventions that make the experience, in my perception, highly dangerous, right? Access to hard drugs, fentanyl, Pitocin, magnesium sulfate, those are hard drugs. They have serious side effects, vacuum instruction, C-section. These are all things, just a small handful of examples that leave women feeling disempowered, traumatized, disconnected from their experience. So because of their definition of safety being avoiding death, they then sacrifice what could be an empowered, safe, non-traumatic experience. So how do we redefine safety? Like, how did we arrive at the definition of safety that we have now? Because most women say, well, at least I made it out alive. Like, I should be grateful, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm laughing at that. But if that's how they view childbirth, we've really done a number on women. The medicalized birth model over the last century has really done a number on women thinking that their bodies you cannot function without medical intervention. Safety is a tough question, Ayla, because there's no such definition. There's no single definition of safety. And in a minute, I'd like to get into the fact that there's no single definition of high risk either. But let's just talk about safety initially. So safety is dependent on most people's life experience and what they've been exposed to. And if you grew up thinking that the doctor always knows best, and you live in a world where you think that modern medicine has created miracles, which it has, then you extrapolate that to mean that everything that a doctor tells you must be the best choice for you. And that's where the mistake is made. And if that's your definition of safety, then who am I to try to talk you out of that? But you are going to find that actually, just based on what I said earlier, the fact that the outcomes in hospitals are not good. They're far worse than they were 50 years ago. So why is that? And the medical system would like to say, well, it's women are older, women are sicker, women are fatter, women are this. You know, it's like really easy to just blame the victim for the problem, but that's not the case. Birth is a very safe thing. Nature designed a system that works very well most of the time if you don't meddle with it. The problem is the medical model does not know how to leave a woman alone in labor. In pregnancy too. Yeah. From the moment you conceive, you're sort of basted in this could go wrong or that can go wrong. You have what's called a problem list on your prenatal record. And, you know, the very first problem on your prenatal list is what? It's that you're pregnant. How do I know that? A couple reasons. One is that the American College of OBGYN says that in some of their guidelines, they say pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition. And I'm not taking that out of context, but if that's the prism by which they see pregnancy, then you understand that. So the other way you know that is something that's subtle that happened to me one time where I was taking a history. And when you take a history, you ask about why they're there. And then you go into meds and allergies and past medical history and past surgical history. And when I got to past medical history, I said to her, like I'd said 1,000 times before, do you have any other medical problems? And she looked at me and she goes, what's the first one? And I realized that even after 30 some years of practicing and probably 5 or 7 years in home birth already, that I was still considering in my brain that pregnancy was the first medical problem. And it isn't. It's a normal bodily function like breathing or digestion, and you don't have to think about it, thank God.
I always say it's a symptom of sex, pregnancy.
It's a side effect, yeah. It's a symptom of sex. No, it's a normal bodily function to grow a baby. You don't have to think about it. And when you start to think about breathing or digestion, you can mess it up. You can hyperventilate. You can have diarrhea because you have to give a speech or go to court or you know, you have a meeting that your boss is going to be, give you a review, and you're nervous about all that. And so your stomach gets upset. That's your higher brain screwing up your lower brain. So where do you feel safe? Well, I would say for the general population, most people feel safest in their home. That's why people, even in a hurricane, don't want to leave their home. They feel like they want to defend their home. It's my safe spot. It's my sanctuary. It's where I want to be. And that's where people feel safest. Now, when it comes to giving birth, some people say, well, I don't want to do that. It's too messy. What happens if? And so they go to the hospital thinking that the hospital is safe. And for me, it's not to convince them that that's not true. But what you said earlier is true, is that when you go to the hospital, you are no longer able to labor physiologically. It's not possible, because you will be interrupted for protocol-dictated procedures that have to be done. You will have questions asked of you. You will have to answer them. You will be put on monitors and in a bed. Thus, the bed becomes the center of attention in the labor room. If you ever walk into a hospital labor room, what's the center of attention? The bed. If you ever go to a home birth and a woman's in active labor, how often do you find her laying in bed? Almost never. Yeah, almost never. So that's a big difference right there. And they're constantly watching you for something to go wrong, whereas in the midwifery model, they're constantly not watching you. They're constantly sort of like my friend calls them ninja lifeguards. They're off listening and quietly not intervening upon you, and they're listening for things or checking for things that might go wrong. And then if they do, then they will step in. But otherwise, they're assuming that everything is going to go right. And in the hospital, they assume that things are going to go wrong in any moment. And therefore, we have to do all these things. You need an IV just in case. You need your blood sent to the lab just in case. You just sign a consent form on admission for C-section just in case. I mean, think about how this sets the mindset of the pregnant woman when she comes in. You change into a hospital gown in most hospitals. Some are waking up. But what does a hospital gown signify? It signifies you're a patient. Why do you have to change into a hospital gown? Why can't you wear your own jammies? Why can't you wear nothing? You're in labor, for God's sakes. You know, you don't need an IV. You should be able to eat and drink. When I talk about this, I often go off into the talking about mammalian birth and how what we do to the human female is antithetical to nature's design in every fashion. And we would not do any of these things to our own pet if they were in labor. So And people say, well, we're different than pets. Well, not really. The only thing that's different is we have a higher cognitive brain, which is actually a detriment to labor.
Right. Holding all the existential fear. Earlier,
gets in the way. Right. So it shuts it down. When an animal senses fear or is interrupted, they put out a hormonal cocktail that causes their labor to stop so they can get up and they can run away. So when a woman senses fear or anxiety, her labor often becomes dysfunctional. And then in our, you know, move them along society, if your labor slows down and you're already at the hospital, they're going to want to do something for you. Because the job of the hospital is to get you in, get your baby out, and get you out. And how that happens, and the story that it tells that you experience while you're there is not their concern. It might be the concern of your individual nurse or your individual doctor, but it's not their concern overall. It's not the concern of the system whatsoever. So safety is one of those things where, like, a lot of men, you know, partners will say, well, you know, they're worried about safety and cost generally. That's what men worry about. I've learned this over the years. And so, but men think that safety is because you have an operating room down the hall. The problem, of course, is that even if you have an operating room down the hall, that doesn't mean you have the necessary personnel to staff that operating room readily available for you should there be a problem. And it doesn't mean that the problem that they're worried about having to take you to the operating floor isn't something that they themselves caused. What's that famously called, the cascade of interventions, where you show up in a labor and your contractions were 3 minutes apart at home, and now they're 5 minutes, 8 minutes apart because you've been stressed out by going through triage and going to asking all these questions and getting in your car and all that stuff. And so now they say, well, you're here anyway, and we're going to do a vaginal exam on you, which is unnecessary. And they check you and you're 4 centimeters. And they say, well, you're 4 centimeters. We might as well keep you because you're 2 days away from your due date, or you're 2 days past your due date. So there's no point in waiting any longer. And they'll probably sweep your membranes or maybe break your bag of waters. And then they'll start an IV, and then they'll, your contractions will space out and they'll want to start Pitocin, but you'll say, I'm too uncomfortable. And they'll say, well, we'll give you an epidural. And then this contraction space out even more. And then they give you Pitocin, and then your baby doesn't like it anymore. And your baby doesn't like, and then doctors don't like the pattern of the baby's heart rate. And they do a C-section and they get a baby that comes out that's perfectly fine. But everybody thinks they did a great job by rescuing a baby.
Yeah. Thank God they were there, right?
But the whole thing, you know, makes me breathless to go through this, because I try to say it without taking a breath, because it becomes that sort of panicked scenario. And here's the thing, though. Hospitals with newborn intensive care units often have a lot of 7-pound babies in them that came into the hospital inside their mother perfectly healthy, and somehow they ended up in the NICU. And there's no explanation for that. What?
I mean, there's got to be, right? I mean, what would you say? Is it the...
No, they're, yeah. I mean, they're saying there's no... They're saying they can't figure out why that happened.
Right, right.
It's obvious to you and me.
It's obvious to you and me. I mean, anything from, like, let's just pick a handful, right? Immediate cord clamping, perhaps exposure to fentanyl and lidocaine for an extended period of time. The mother's, you know, being under a stress response for an extended period of time, not natural, normal labor stress response, but something heightened. What else? What else can we think of that would cause?
Hyperstimulated with synthetic oxytocin. Mother starved. Because she's basically allowed popsicles and clear liquids. And she's been in labor for 20 hours. So baby's not getting the same nutrients and stuff coming across that it normally would. Baby being disconnected from mom when she gets her epidural. There I have theories about how that happens. We see it not uncommonly that baby's heart rate patterns change after mom gets an epidural. Again, immobilizing a mom, not allowing her to help her baby in any certain way, laying on your back and affect how your blood flow is to your pelvis. So there's lots of reasons why that happens. And then the baby comes out with a little bit of floppiness, and because they have a NICU team or a pediatric team available, they hit the button on the wall and the team comes down and the baby turns out to be fine. But now that they've had to intervene on the baby, they say, you know what? We need to watch the baby for a while. So we're going to take the baby to the NICU or to the nursery and keep an eye on your baby for a while. It's like, we can keep an eye on our baby. Best thing for your baby is to be connected to its umbilical cord, getting its own auto transfusion, skin to skin with mom's temperature, mom's voice, mom's skin, mom's bacteria. Those are the things that babies need. And the hospital model for decades was clamp the cord immediately, which is stupid, and then show this beautiful thing that mother just delivered, show it to her, and then walk it across the room and set it down in the warmer so that the nurses can dry it off and rub it down and, you know, put goop in its eyes and sometimes even give it injections.
And aspirate it and bruise the back of its throat.
Right. That's right. Do all those things and then wrap it up like a burrito and put a hat on it. And then, of course, that towel is covered in hospital-based bacteria, and the hat is unnecessary. And then they put the baby on the mom's chest for a little while. And then they say, okay, we have to take the baby to the nursery now. And the baby goes, I mean, again, these things are changing, but this is the stuff that people think is safe. And, you know, you may. But I'm just saying that just because you're in a labor room does not mean that you can get a baby out emergently when there is a bradycardia on the fetal heart rate, possibly iatrogenically caused, and that they run you down the hall and you're thinking that, you know, there's an anesthesiologist there, a surgeon, an assistant surgeon, a scrub nurse, a circulating nurse, all just standing around waiting for you for this disaster that's happening. And that's not the case. And sometimes you don't have a lot of time. So the best thing to do is to avoid that situation in the first place. What's the best way to avoid that situation in the first place? Is for most women is to stay out of the hospital. Stay out of the hospital. Have a skilled, knowledgeable practitioner, usually a midwife, occasionally a doctor like me, be on your team at your home or birth center, wherever you feel most comfortable being, and letting labor go as it normally does. Because when you don't mess with Mother Nature, you rarely see the rapid deterioration of fetal status that you sometimes see in the hospital setting. Midwives are really good at normal birth, and therefore, when something abnormal is starting to happen, they recognize it right away. And most of us live in areas where we do have access to a hospital that's not more than 15 to 30 minutes away. And that's plenty of time when something's not emergent. And almost all transports from home are not emergencies. They're sent because either things aren't progressing or mom's exhausted or baby's developing a rising heart rate or something where you can get in the car and drive to the hospital. And then that's when the hospital has use. And the problem is, of course, that's maybe 15% of the time. But if we took 85% of births away from the hospital, which I would love to see happen, and then hospitals couldn't keep their doors open anymore as far as their obstetric thing. So there is this dilemma where we need to figure out a plan to work together with these people to try to come up with a better way of doing things. But if you think you're going to get a physiologic birth by going to the hospital and saying, just leave me alone, that's not possible.
Yeah, it's a strange sort of collusion that women get into with their medical providers, because they'll say, oh, I showed my doctor my birth plan and, you know, he agrees with most of it, but there are some points where he rolled his eyes, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. I'll just show up and, you know, kind of when the time comes, I'll just put my foot down. Right. And I'm like, well, he might not be there. It's nurses you've never met before. And being in labor is not really like the time where you want to put your foot down. You want to be completely surrendered to your environment. Right. And so this is not the time to get into a back and forth about, you know, bathing the baby or not bathing the baby, the IV or not the IV, the hep block or not the hep block. So why go into a situation where you're going to have to fight for your autonomy, you know? And if you are, then do you have an equipped partner, husband with you to do that on your behalf? Because it really shouldn't be the role of the woman to do that in that space. You know, I think so many women, from my experience as a doula and a birth educator and doing a lot of prenatal planning and all that with my clients, they want this natural physiological experience. However, they've heard so many stories of lives getting saved in hospitals. And once we go through this whole, you know, explanation of how they were caused by the environment itself, right? These complications were actually caused by the environment itself, they start to see that those stories really come from electing an epidural, electing an induction, electing things that were not necessary, but that birth actually is a lot safer when you're out of the environment. So I think it's just an unlearning and a relearning that has to happen. You know, it has to come from the woman. I don't know that these institutions are ever going to like collaborate with us. I think it's more about the woman on a ground level changing her perspective, you know, one woman at a time, right? So what are everyone's big questions are, what are the emergencies? Like, what are the things you can detect, right? Towards the end of the pregnancy, for example, or even in the pregnancy midway, that would qualify a woman to work with a high-risk specialist, which is what I've always considered an OB/GYN is a high-risk specialist. There are I don't even know if there are more than one of you, Dr. Stu, in the world, because you're one of the few people I know who, you know, you're a physician and you see women in the home and you're assuming everything's going to go right until it doesn't, right? That's your perspective. But I don't know anybody else like that. Maybe Dr. Bradley, who, you know, I studied the Bradley method over 10 years ago, but he believed that too. So, and like, you know, but how do women build that discernment within them? You know, how do they, you know, they're at a crossroad, right? At the beginning of the pregnancy, I've been told I have a condition. I've been told that I'm, you know, 37, I have a geriatric pregnancy. I need to watch things more closely. how in that moment do they develop that internal, what I call the internal masculine, that discernment to say, I'm going to try something else. I'm going to get another opinion. I'm going to unlearn this. I'm going, you know, like where, how can they do that?
Today's culture, it's not easy to do. You've painted a real dilemma that truly exists out there, because our culture has taught women that pregnancy is a very potentially a high risk. And it's very unlikely for any woman who goes through an obstetrical model of care to come out of her pregnancy without some label at some point that there's something wrong with her pregnancy, whether it's pregnancy itself, or whether, as you said, she's over 35, or she's short and her husband's tall, or she goes beyond her due date, or she has mild hypothyroidism for which she's taking low-dose levothyroxine, or an ultrasound, everything looks fine, but the baby's a little on the small side, or the baby has one isolated left ventricular echogenic focus, and this is something that doesn't really mean anything, but we want to see you back in 6 weeks, and then we're going to follow you. Or you're over 35, and that means your placenta could give out, so we're going to start testing your baby at 35 weeks every week, which of course makes no sense because the testing isn't set up to be every week. It's set up to be twice a week. So when some doctor tells you you need testing once a week, they're telling you you don't need testing is what they're telling you. But they don't see it that way because they see pregnancy as high risk in general. But high risk is not a number. A woman over 35 is not high risk, right? A woman who's 40 weeks and 6 days going on 41 weeks is not high risk. A woman who has mild hypertension or well-controlled diabetes does not have to be called high risk, right? High risk is not, again, I want to emphasize this, high risk that I've determined in all my meanderings through is not really a number. High risk is something that makes the doctor uncomfortable because the doctors will be more comfortable with things that carry more risks than other things, which they will label high risk. For instance, which is riskier? Having a woman be over 35 or inducing her labor at 39 weeks, which carries more risk. Yet they'll think the 39-week thing is fine, but the woman over 35 is high risk. Which carries more risk? Having a VBAC or having a repeat cesarean section? Think about it. Which carries more risk? They'll tell you the VBAC carries more risk. I would tell you that the C-section carries more risk, especially if that woman wants a third baby or a fourth baby. But they won't, you know, they don't look at it like that. And here's one that somebody sent me, or I saw it on a meme once, which makes me laugh hysterically. The American College of OBGYN thinks that it's safer to give a woman 6 vaccines while she's pregnant, none of which that have ever been tested for safety in anyone, let alone in pregnant women. Violation of the precautionary principle, which is you never give experimental substances to pregnant women. We're talking about the flu vaccine, the COVID vaccine, the DTaP vaccine, which is three vaccines, and the RSV vaccine at 32 to 36 weeks. So they think it's safer to do that. But they tell a pregnant woman that she should probably avoid any alcohol, sushi, or raw milk. So I got you laughing about that one. I mean, think about it. Let's inject at least, I know that the DTaP and the has 400 micrograms of aluminum in it. I know that the mRNA has who knows what kind of damage it's doing, right? The flu vaccine hardly works at all. And if it's from a batch flu vaccine, it has mercury in it. If it's a singular dose flu vaccine, then it doesn't have mercury generally. You can check with that if you're going to get a flu vaccine. And I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm just telling you I would never do these things while I'm pregnant because there's no safety testing. I mean, there's no safety testing when you're not pregnant either. But if that's a choice for your own body, but putting this stuff in your body when you have a fetus developing inside of you, and that's okay. But drinking raw milk or having some sushi is not okay. You gotta be careful with that.
Or like avoiding going to the nail salon. Like, I mean, there's so many, how are we gauging the level of safety, right?
Well, I hate going to the nail salon anyway, I used to go with my daughter and I'd have to sit outside because it was very strong. It was a strong smell in there.
It is, it is. It absolutely is, you know? And it's interesting. I was just talking to Lily Nichols and she was explaining to me how selenium actually binds to the mercury in fish. So it's actually better to eat raw fish. I'm not quoting her. She did not say it's better to eat raw fish, but we were making allusions to the possibility that eating raw fish actually has more health benefit than the cooked fish because once you cook the fish, the selenium is gone. Apparently. And so it's, you know, what did all these, what even the mercury remains, there's nothing for it to bind to, for it to leave your system. So What did these women in Japan do? Like, what have they been doing for centuries? And what have, like,
they're having mutant babies constantly.
And the women in France no. eating the raw cheese and the raw honey. And
yeah, and drinking wine at every dinner meal, stuff like that. It, again, these are the same people that are telling you that the food pyramid was right when it was upside down. And the same people that told you to take Vioxx and thalidomide and diethylstilbestrol and put mercury in baby's teething powder. And tell you to take statins and SSRIs and the COVID vaccine, and you're getting in. The CDC is still recommending the COVID vaccine down to 6 months of age, the new booster, and recommending that pregnant women get the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine to prevent RSV in babies 0 to 6 months. They don't tell you, by the way, because I looked into this, and like the pertussis vaccine. All right. They want you to have it ahead of time in case your baby would get pertussis before it can get its first vaccine against pertussis. So the question is, for many things like this, is like, well, okay, so we want to prevent RSV or pertussis in newborns. How many unvaccinated newborns get pertussis and RSV to the point where they need to be hospitalized and or die? Wouldn't that be a number that a parent should want to know before they decide to give all pregnant women this? But no, because you know why? Because there's no money in not giving vaccines. If there was an RVS code, which is a billing code, for not giving vaccines, then doctors would probably be more likely to not give vaccines, but they can't bill for that. For some people, what I just said will just sound outrageous, but I'm telling you, it's true. Doctors are given incentives to give these vaccines. They have to know that there's no safety testing. If they don't know there's no safety testing, that's on them. Right, we weren't taught about vaccines other than what a miracle they were in medical school. That's what we're taught. I think that's probably still what's taught now, because medical schools, by the way, are pretty much run by who? Big Pharma.
Big Pharma, of course.
Big Pharma supports them, right? So that's where the money comes from medical schools.
So pediatricians are functioning within this model as well, just so that that's clear. It's not just the physicians who are supporting.
Some pediatrician offices get incentives from insurance companies or pharmaceutical companies for having a higher percentage of their children vaccinated. And we know this because it's come out through FOIA and other possible ways it's been disclosed. And then I get letters from people all the time saying my pediatrician was kicking me out of my practice because I won't vaccinate my kids. Now, think about this for a second. If you get a bonus for the percentage of kids that are vaccinated in your practice, then one of the things you can do is vaccinate more kids. The other thing you can do is kick out kids from your practice that aren't vaccinated. It's very sinister what they're doing. They're kicking you out not because they don't want to respect your right to do that. They're kicking you out because your child is hurting their numbers. It's awful.
Well, there's a pediatrician here locally who said that there's periodic audits with records of patients to see how many unvaccinated patients there are. And there's like a threshold. Basically, you're not supposed to pass a certain number. You can have a handful of unvaccinated patients, but there has to be some sort of reason that they're not getting any vaccines, right? Childhood vaccinations.
And who's doing this audit?
I don't know who's doing this audit.
Yeah, it's probably the insurance company.
Right. And he said, I'm hoping to retire soon, but I'm going to do some good. But towards the end of my career, and he said, you know, I have 90% of my patients are not vaccinated, you know. And so he said, and so one day it'll just all come down. But for now, I'm doing my part, right? He woke up.
Yeah, well, my colleague Paul Thomas published his data on that. And you know, I think it was in 19 different categories of health, from anything from like eczema to asthma to autism to Crohn's disease to, you know, childhood diabetes. They looked at kids that had no vaccines at all versus kids that were fully vaccinated according to the CDC schedule. And in all 19 categories, the healthier kids were the ones that had no vaccines. And for that, he lost his medical license, and his paper that was published was pulled. And yet it's all true. The same thing happened to Andy Wakefield, who I had the privilege of interviewing on our podcast a couple months ago, who just pointed out that, geez, these mostly little black boys who were getting the MMR vaccine were coming in with GI problems, intestinal problems, and also had associated autism. And because Andy was a gastroenterologist, he published a paper saying, this is a very interesting finding. We ought to look into it more. And for that, he was published. He didn't say MMR causes autism. He said there might be a link and it should be investigated. And that was enough to trigger this. And this was 20 some years ago. And it's only, the tyranny's only gotten worse now.
Just shining a little light, you can't do that.
Back to safety, back to high risk. Neither one of them is objective. They're both subjective. And so the bar can change. It can move depending on who you're talking to. So we have to respect that for some patients, safety means hospital. And for many, it means not going to the hospital. And the same thing for high risk. If you are somebody who maybe you're, you know, again, in my practice, if you're a breech baby, you're breech at term, that is not high risk. It's high risk to the obstetrician who doesn't know how to do breech delivery.
Could you pause a moment and for everyone listening, explain briefly what breech is and the various types of breech?
Yeah. Okay. So a breech baby is a baby that instead of coming head down, which is what 96% of babies will be at term, it comes butt first or the legs first with the butt. There are four major categories of breech. Again, everything is nuanced. But there's frank breech where the baby's in what's called like the diving pike position, where the hips are flexed and the knees are extended and the feet are up by the baby's face. That's the most common type of breech. Probably 75-80% of breeches are going to be frank breech at term. Second most common is complete breech. That's where the baby's sitting with his legs folded underneath it, sort of like yoga position or used to say Indian style, you know, that way. Yeah. And that is, you know, probably 15% or more. And then there's incomplete breech, which is where one of the legs is folded underneath and one of the legs is sticking up like a frank breech. And then there's footling breech, which is where both legs and both knees and hips are extended, like the baby is standing up. That's extremely rare at term because there's not room for a baby to do that. And it's unfortunately named as a footling breech because if you have a complete or incomplete breech and you're in labor, sometimes the foot will drop out. Baby comes down, and people who don't know anything will call it a footling breech, and they'll panic. Well, they'll panic with any breech, but they'll panic more so because footlings, you know, theoretically are harder to deliver because they can fall through an incompletely dilated cervix. But that is not the case at term. Yet my colleagues know very little about breech birth. They've basically learned in the last 25, 30 years that breech is dangerous and all breeches should be done by C-section. And the data does not support that. There was one outlying paper that did, and that's the one they chose to do, and that's something we call confirmation bias. They chose the paper that supported the way they want to practice. Why do they want to not do vaginal breech delivery? One, because they're worried and they're scared and they're untrained, and two, it's easier to do a C-section. You can be in at 7:30, out at 8:15. The pay is a little bit better, possibly, but the pay for the hospital is a lot better, and they're not training doctors, so they're very nervous about it. And if they're nervous about it, they're going to project their anxiety onto the women of our country, and then the women of our country are nervous about it. And so it's gotten labeled as something that's dangerous when it's not. The Royal College of OBGYN has the best statistics on this. And the instance of neonatal death with a breech birth at term is about 2 per 1,000. And the instance of neonatal death with a head down baby at term is about 1 per 1,000. So in other words, for every 1,000 babies you deliver vaginally that are breech, you'll have one extra neonatal death than you would if you had a head down baby. So what the medical model is telling you is that we should section 1,000 women to save one baby, because they're not telling you to section 1,000 women to save one head down baby. So you compare the two. What often happens is compared to the risks at C-section. And the risks at C-section are less. They're about 1 in 2,000 babies will die from a C-section, but so will 1 in 2,000 mothers will die from a C-section. And then if you do a C-section on a breech baby, if it's a mom's first baby, and you want a second baby, you've now done nothing but pass the risk that you saved on the first baby to that second baby and all the mom's future babies, because now they have the scarred uterus issue and the whole VBAC issue and the ruptured uterus issue and that whole issue. So breech, what used to be when I was training, and I trained in the early 80s, it used to be just a variation of normal. And as a matter of fact, we used to like them. We used to fight for who's going to get the lady in room 6 with the breech baby.
Who dropped that?
Because they were fun to do.
Who dropped this idea in? Like, who decided that that was going to be removed from your training?
Well, it's blamed on a paper that came out in 2000 called the Term Breech Trial, but it had already been on the way out. I think the term breech trial was just a paper that someone said, we need a paper to convince everybody to do what we want to do. And that's what they did. I think the ARRIVE trial for the 39-week thing was the same thing. I have evidence for that, but that's another topic for another day. But
yeah, I would love to have that conversation. But do you think this was all just a push, kind of like getting everything into the corner to be classified under the umbrella of necessary for a C-section? I mean, just if we're going to say like, these are the conditions for allowing a normal, you know, a vaginal birth, and then everything else is slowly going to get pushed into the umbrella of requiring a C-section.
Yeah, I think what happened was there were probably some bad outcomes with breech babies that scared academicians and scared insurance companies and risk managers, and probably because the people doing the breech deliveries didn't know what they were doing. So it wasn't the fact that the baby was breech; it was probably the fact that the people that were attending them were unskilled, and so they had a bad outcome. So they just said, "Well, let's just section all breeches and we'll get them out before the, you know," and what really was frightening about that, and there are stories abound that women who came in with the baby starting to come out with the butt or the feet coming out of the vagina, and they push the baby back up inside to do a C-section on the baby, where they still have to deliver the baby breech. They're just doing it through the abdominal incision instead of the vaginal opening. Again, the logic behind this just escapes me. I think they think they can, whatever they cut open, they can make bigger and they can get a baby out, and they can always sew the mom up. And again, there's no concern for what the mother's feeling or mother's thinking. There's only fear. These are fear responses. Get the baby and get a live baby in the bassinet is my signature statement that I say that's all that matters to them, and how the baby gets there is not their concern. What happens to that mother and that mother's future babies is not their concern. And again, I'm not saying the individual nurse or doctor doesn't feel that concern, but the individual nurse and doctor now is just a cog in a wheel. They're no longer, I mean, one of the worst things that happened in my lifetime was seeing doctors become employees. I mean, doctors could have been arrogant son of a bitches, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. You know, there was a God complex, and that was true. But at least they were responsible for the women or the women that they were taking care of. And the consumer, you know, went to that person, and that person, they made a transaction, and that person was then therefore their practitioner. And that person was only responsible, that doctor was only responsible to that woman. When doctors became employees of hospitals, they now were a salaried position, working a shift, and they had an overlord who could now tell them, you know, our policy is we're not letting anyone go past 41 weeks. So you need to counsel all the women that need to be delivered before 41 weeks. Even though that doctor may have known that there's no reason that this woman needs to be delivered before 41 weeks, if that doctor honors what that woman wants to wait, he's going to get in trouble. He's going to lose his Christmas bonus. He's going to get yelled at. He could get fired, or she. So doctors now had their fiduciary duty conflicted, because am I responsible to my patient, or am I responsible to the person paying my salary? And that's a big issue. And unfortunately, the patient loses most of the time, because courage is the least common trait in humans in 2024. So many of us lack the courage to stand up and fight. It's very easy to put a hashtag up and say, you know, hashtag this, that, or the other thing to all your sycophants on Instagram and feel like you've done something virtuous. But it would be much more virtuous for you to go to a group that doesn't disagree with you. That doesn't agree with you, and have that same conversation. Yeah. And the problem is that those people generally won't let you come. Like, I'd be willing to speak to anybody. You know, I look at the political system right now. I look at RFK Jr. is willing to speak to anybody who will listen. Whereas you have the other part of the Democratic Party who basically kicked him out. They don't want to speak to anybody unless they're a sycophant. Wouldn't it have been nice back in 2020 and 2021 when COVID first hit, if President Trump and then President Biden had said to Fauci and to Deborah Birx, you know, I've just got ordered 2 hours of national television time, and we're going to put you two on with Peter McCullough and Jay Bhattacharya or Robert Malone, and we're going to have a national debate monitored by, you know, somebody from CNN or from Fox or whatever, it doesn't really matter, or monitored by the press secretary or something, and we're going to have a national debate so that people can hear your side and the other side, and then they can make a decision for themselves. Wouldn't that have been the presidential thing to do? So wouldn't it be nice if the people who think that the hospital model is so great were to be able to sit and have a conversation with people who think the hospital model isn't so great, and have a point counterpoint discussion? But the people in power will never do that. They will not sit because quite frankly, their positions and their outcomes are indefensible. They are indefensible. If you look at the outcomes of where we're at right now with more chronic illness in children than we've ever had before. Now, there could be many reasons for that, but one of them is how we start in life. It does parallel the rise in C-section rate, the rising placenta accreta rate, the rising postpartum depression rate, the rising rate of, well, the effect on the microbiome, the fact that inductions are now 30, 40% of all pregnancies, less than 50% of women go into labor spontaneously in 2024. In our country, in Australia, in England, that's crazy that less than 50% of women can go into labor as nature intended. And in some countries, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80% up to are having cesarean section.
And a lot of people say to me, well, what's wrong with this? We have a live baby, they're healthy, they're functional, right? But then our definition of a healthy child is so subjective, and we have women who are functional and just underneath the surface, highly traumatized and barely getting by, don't want to have any more children. And if they do, they don't want to be a participant in the process because of the previous experience they had. So when people say, well, what's wrong with that? So what? So what if women are medicated? So what if babies are medicated? So what if the woman is induced? Everybody's here now.
Yep. And we're sicker than we've ever been.
And we're sicker than we've ever been. We're more disconnected, disassociated than we've ever been, right? The addiction to everything is on the rise, to technology, pornography, foods, certain behaviors, right? The nuclear family is completely disconnected. And for me, it's the way that we're birthing. I mean, we have the power to shift that. We have the power to make a different choice. And you've been on the other side of the consultation desk for so long, right? What is it in a woman where she puts all, what is it in her that wants to put all the power in her doctor's hands? Where does that come from? Is it something from childhood, wanting to people please, wanting to get that love and connection from an authority figure? What is it in her that says, I'll do whatever you say and I will shut down my intuition to do whatever you say, whatever you think is best?
It isn't one thing, and each person has a different life story. But the leading motivator is fear. And again, fear is something there are innate fears that we have. We know instinctually, we don't have to be taught that if we're being chased by a lion, we should run. I think that that's an instinctual thing. But a lot of fear is learned behavior. And we have a culture that benefits from scaring people, because once you scare people, you can manipulate them to do anything you want. We just went through that. So in our culture, when you see childbirth, when you hear people talking about it, when your mother-in-law tells her story, sometimes they're glorious stories, but most of the time they're not. Most of the time, the stories of this happened and this happened, and then I went to the hospital and this happened and this happened. And thank God I was at the hospital because this happened. And this gets passed down as something that it's dangerous. But you know how I know it's not? And it's not just from sitting across the table, because as I got more into the home birth world, I got a skewed population. I got people who are already thinking like-minded. People who are very scared are not going to be looking for home birth options. It's just not the case. But you know how I know this is because there are cultures around the world where the things that you just described are not true. There are cultures like the Amish population, for instance. The Amish population don't have social media. They don't read newspapers. Women talk to each other, they tell stories. It's a rite of passage for them. An Amish woman may even know somebody in their community who passed away from childbirth. Yet they have no fear of childbirth, or very minimal fear of childbirth, because they know that their bodies are designed for this, and it's their right. As Rachel Reed writes, it's a rite of passage for them. Same thing goes on in women from third world countries who live, when I used to meet women came up from El Salvador, or Guatemala, or Nicaragua, right? Very uneducated, but again, very comfortable with the fact they were pregnant and had their babies, hardly ever complained, just went through it. And then you take the women from the Upper West Side and Upper East Side of Manhattan or the West Side of Los Angeles, and they are freaking out because then you get the people that say, well, you would never have a tooth pulled without Novocaine. Why would you have a baby without an epidural? And there's a good conversation for that, but for face value, it sounds very reasonable, but you're altering nature's design. So fear is the thing that makes women surrender their autonomy. And then you've heard of the, you know, the whole fawning in the face of authority. You know, women will fawn, men will fight, women will often fawn. That's just the way it we're built inside. And by the way, it's an interesting theory about how vaccine injury tends to affect males more than females. That's a whole nother story. It's a book read by a man named Forrest McGreedy. I think it's called The Autism Vaccine, but I've read several of his books. And he talks about, you know, the way when you get injected with a needle, your fight and flight response goes on, especially if you're 2 years old, right? You're being held down. So a boy, when he's held down, wants to fight back. A girl, when she's held down, may want to fight back. I'm not saying that, but most of the time they'll just surrender. So if this is a neurotoxin, maybe it's affecting the males differently because their brain and something's different going on in their brain. This is a theory that he has.
Chemically different, of course. Dr. Hamer talks about this with German New Medicine, which is why there are these full body rashes or different reactions that occur in newborns when they're vaccinated, simply because it creates a psycho-emotional conflict of being violated. I mean, just the prick, just the being held down, even during circumcision as well, it creates the psycho-emotional conflict of a violation, and therefore the skin will react because the skin is the first barrier that we have, the first defense that we have between ourselves and the outside world. And so that will get triggered every time that child moving forward feels violated or that their boundaries are overstepped. That same rash, the same outbreak will occur. And then they'll think it's a chronic issue due to God knows what, but really it's from the original violation conflict that happened at the time that that first injection was given, the Hep B at birth, or even the PKU prick, the heel prick, anything like that that causes a violation to the skin, to the system, to the body, will create that emotional conflict.
And I think what listeners ought to understand is that whether it's large or small, whether it's visible presently or maybe 10 years down the road, every time you intervene in Mother Nature's design, there will be ripple effects. There will be downstream consequences, some of them insignificant, some of them we don't understand, some of them maybe not be determinable for 10 or 20 years, but there will be downstream consequences. And when they study a drug like hepatitis vaccine for newborns, they studied that drug, I think, for 48 hours, all right? I might be wrong, it might be 5 days, but either way, it's either 2 days or 5 days. And then they deemed it safe. And when you see that kind of gaslighting, you have to understand that there's no way that you should trust anything that they're telling you. If they're not standing up and saying that there's something wrong with that sort of a way of testing something, because you're not looking downstream. You know, you could give somebody a medicine today and you might find that it causes heart disease 20 years later. If they studied tobacco and smoking for 48 hours, no one would have gotten lung cancer and they would have said it's safe and effective. It's what they would have said about tobacco. You know, they looked, you know, eventually they looked downstream and they went after the tobacco companies who then got into the food business. And now think about where that's taken us. God, it's all so sinister and intertwined.
It's so intertwined. It's such a web. And oh my gosh, there's so much more to explore in this web.
Just again, to reiterate those two points about safety and about high risk, they're very culturally oriented. There are certain things that my OB colleagues would consider high risk that I have that are not high risk at all. They do many things, as I said earlier, that are far riskier in numbers than something that they label high risk, like induction of labor or breech vaginal delivery, which carries more risk. And they'll tell you that the breech delivery carries more risk, and I'll tell you that it absolutely does not. So it's based on experience and perspective and that sort of thing. And so my mission, again, with these last quarter or third of my life, is to keep the skills alive. And the people that are interested in learning that are midwives. And I think midwives are the future of women's childbearing care, because OBs are creating their own obsolescence. You mentioned something earlier about an OB being an expert in high-risk pregnancy, and I would tell you they're not. OBs are trained to not be experts in high-risk pregnancy. OBs are trained to be dependent on maternal fetal medicine doctors, who are the ones teaching OBs in medical school and residency. Who are the professors? They're the MFMs. So what they're doing is they're creating a marketing tool. They're sending out OBs out there to find things to send them for referrals to make money. Because when I was a doctor, I used a maternal fetal medicine doctor very rarely. You know, I was trained to do my own ultrasounds. I did my own amniocentesis when it was necessary. I was trained to do all those things. I was trained to take care of a diabetic when she was pregnant or a hypothyroid woman when she was pregnant. That's what you learned in residency. You learned all things pregnancy. Now, doctors are taught that if a woman has any of those things I just said, you need to refer them to an MFM. And I don't think that any woman in the medicalized birth model these days gets through her pregnancy without being at least labeled as something that's high risk or seeing a maternal fetal medicine specialist, which are supposed to be very narrow specialty, very, very narrow specialty, right? So one of the things that I talk about with about breech birth, which is something that goes along this line, is that breech birth is a specific skill that an obstetrician should have. If an obstetrician doesn't have that skill, they are not what I would call a complete obstetrician. So if you have an internal medicine doctor who finds somebody who's got unstable angina in their heart, that doctor then refers that person to a cardiologist, right? That makes sense? If a pediatrician finds a kid that has some very weird rash, that pediatrician will send that kid to a dermatologist, probably a pediatric dermatologist, right? Okay, so an obstetrician has a woman comes into his practice who's got twins or breech. They're not an expert in twins or breech. Why are they keeping those patients in their practice? Why aren't they sending them to an expert in breech or twin delivery? And they're saying, well, we're sending them to an MFM. Well, the MFM isn't an expert in breech or twin delivery either. They're an expert in scaring women that with twins that they have to have multiple ultrasounds. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't, but they don't differentiate because all twins are put on an algorithm. You know, if you have mono-mono twins, you have to be delivered by 32 weeks. If you have mono-die twins, you have to be delivered by 36 to 37 weeks. And if you have die-die twins by 38 weeks, it's like none of that's true. Zero of what I just said is true. And yet that is the algorithm. That is a standard. That is what comes out of Harvard University, the Brigham and Women's Hospital. That's their standard. And who's going to go against Harvard?
Right. So twin delivery is also a dying art form, just like breech delivery.
Right. 75% of twins in the United States are delivered by cesarean section. And by the way, 10% of the remaining 25% have a vaginal delivery for twin A and then have a C-section for twin B because the person doesn't know how to reach up and pull out a second twin that might be in trouble. Right. So why are they taking care of twins in the first place?
Would that be for a monochorionic twin that they would do that? They would section?
No, it could be any die-die twins, any twins. First twin comes out head down and the second twin turns sideways or breech and they panic and they don't know what to do. And this is a skill that I teach in my class, how to reach up inside and grab the baby's feet and pull the baby out and pull the baby down and out and having the maneuvers to do it. And you can do that literally in 20 seconds as opposed to taking a woman to the operating room and taking 15 or 20 minutes to get the second baby out and then scarring the woman and making any future pregnancies more difficult for her. And yet these obstetricians don't know how to do that. And yet they keep these women in their care. If a doctor who doesn't know how to do breech delivery or doesn't know how to do a breech extraction finds out a woman has twins at 10 weeks pregnant, here's what he or she should say to them. Wow, this is really exciting. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you. I'm not the person that should be taking care of you, however, and I'm going to send you to so-and-so who does, you know, who's really skilled in vaginal delivery of twins.
Right.
But they don't. You know, that's an ego thing. Or maybe they just never thought about it. Maybe they just think that they're the expert, but they're not the expert because they're afraid. And they send, they won't scratch their nose without getting a maternal fetal medicine consult. I was going to say scratch something else, but I'm trying to be polite. Right. Yeah, it's exhausting, isn't it?
I mean, it is. And it's my...
I'm sorry to exhaust your audience. I've exhausted your audience for an hour.
It's incredibly... For me, it's incredibly stimulating. And it's also... It feels like one of my students in the doula training say, like, I just feel like we're trying to run water uphill sometimes when we're trying to create a container or a space for women to be in a more autonomous way of being, you know, and to get them the information that they need to make more informed decisions. It feels like such a battle. And I said, well, it's just one woman at a time. We each have a small petri dish and it's just about revealing options and, you know, for women to feel that they're in freedom of choice because they are. Like, we have these self-created prisons. We feel like we can't choose differently, but we can. We just need to know what's possible. So these conversations are incredibly important.
Yeah, you know, I've made a list of questions that women should interview when they talk to their OB for the first time. We're going to put it on our Patreon segment eventually, but our Patreon page. But I've made a list of questions that are just simple questions. If you want, I can rattle off some of them to you. And again, what I would tell women who are looking for an OB or an obstetrician or a midwife for that matter, but don't just go there because that person's been doing your pap smear for a decade. You need to ask more questions than that. And at your first OB visit, it should be an interview and it should be you interviewing them, not them interviewing you. You should not be going through an entire history with them. You should not be letting them take your blood pressure or draw blood on you. You should be going there, interviewing them and asking them certain questions to find out if you're comfortable with this person being the one that's taking care of you. And it depends on what your priorities are. And again, my questions kind of lead toward my vision of what birth should be like. But let me pull it up and let me just read it off to you here. These are some of them. They're not in any particular order. What is your policy if I go past 40 weeks? 41 weeks. How do you feel about induction? Are you comfortable with a breech baby at term? Do you think age 35 is significant? If so, why do you think that? And then what are the actual risks of me being 35? Not the relative risks, the actual risks. Are you comfortable with me declining certain tests like diabetes screening or GBS or some ultrasounds? What is your policy and concerns if my water were to break at term before labor? What is your habit regarding vaginal exams? Can I labor and deliver in any position? How do you feel about intermittent or continuous fetal monitoring? Are you willing to deliver twins naturally? What about if either or both are breech? What's your policy about me eating in labor? How do you feel about me having a doula? How long can I delay cord clamping? So these are just getting started with the list.
I know, we're just getting started.
Things to ask your doctor. Now, here's a good red flag. Thanks to my Down to Birth podcast friends. If your doctor starts to roll their eyes, if their doctor says, I don't have time to do this right now, or looks like they want to have one foot out the door, take them for what they're telling you what they think of you. So believe them and go elsewhere. If they're not going to give you the time of day to answer simple questions like this, they're not going to give you the time of day to answer more complicated questions as your pregnancy progresses. These are not long, these questions don't require long answers.
I think the challenging part about asking these questions is that it might mean there isn't a physician available for this woman. Right? And that might mean coming into contact with something deeper that the woman has to contend with, which is an out-of-hospital birth. And what does that mean for her? You know, so it's a journey. It's a beautiful journey, but it can reveal a lot to us, right?
Right. But you have to put the effort into it. And I would tell women actually to ask these questions of their OB before they're even pregnant. At one of your gynecology visits, if you have, you go in for some sort of, again, routine visits are not necessary either, but say you're still going in for your routine GYN visit, ask these questions. Do some research. Investigate your community. If you're going to move, by the way, we always investigate schools, playgrounds, you know, do they have a Costco? You know, that sort of thing. We look. But we often don't look at, what's the hospital like there? What's the labor? Do they have a labor and delivery unit? What's their C-section rate at the hospital? Maybe even go visit. If you're going to have kids and you're going to raise them in that neighborhood, maybe go visit the charge nurse and talk to the nurses in labor and delivery as part of your, interviewing process. And maybe put some money aside for it as well. You know, everybody's heard the wedding analogy by now where you save money and you pay a fortune for your wedding and you get to pick out everything that you want. You pick out the cake, the color of the napkins, you invite people you like, you pick the venue and all that stuff. And, you know, but for your birth, which is the probably more important event in your life, you relegate that to a third party payer. And you would never do that for your wedding. And so why do we do it for our birth?
Well, I've noticed that we focus a lot on the conception itself, right? Many of us go through the entire rigmarole of IVF. We kind of pay some attention to the pregnancy. We want to check out for the birth, and then we expect that we'll just have a baby, you know, after it's all said and done. And there are so many points in this rite of passage, right? There's the conception itself. There's preparation for the conception itself, the pregnancy, the birth, and then the postpartum and going into the beautiful journey of parenting. So there is this desire to want to check out, can I just get pregnant and then get the baby? But everything in between, there's too much self-reflection. There's too many choices to make. It's too scary. It's too painful. And so are you seeing, or, you know, over the decades of your practice and doing this work, have you seen that there is a direct relationship between the way the woman approaches her pregnancy and birth to postpartum depression and the way she experiences her early parenting journey.
Of course, I couldn't quantify that for you, but I just know that how a person is treated, whether it's in pregnancy or whether it's at a restaurant or whether it's on a dating app, matters. It matters to how you perceive things and how you respond. When you're treated with dignity and respect, even if somebody tells you that they disagree with you, you can have a respectful conversation. I mean, a great example of that is my podcast, all right? Bliss and I disagree on a lot of subjects, and yet we're able to come together because we have a higher mission and a deep respect for each other that transcends the pettiness that can happen between two people who, you know, one watches CNN, one watches Fox, and those people can't have a conversation about anything. So how you're treated matters to how you respond and how you may very well have, you know, suppressed feelings, which may very well turn into depression or anxiety or sleep disorders or whatever else, because they manifest in many different ways in different people. And everybody deals with those things in their own way, that we've all grown up with different, you know, influences upon us. And so there's no one size fits all. And that really bothers, by the way, the medical model, which loves algorithms. They love to put all diabetics into one category or all twins into one category. And they're not. Every individual twin mom is a different story. But the system doesn't give the doctors and nurses the time to investigate that individual story because the middlemen need to make more money. It's always about the money, Ayla. It's always about the money.
I see it everywhere I turn with everything that's going on out there right now. So
yeah, it is. I mean, why do food companies take out some of the toxic stuff when they sell food in England or Canada, but they put it in our food here in the United States? Why don't they just give us all the good food, if there is such a thing? You know, why would they do that?
And why is it prohibited in certain countries to advertise pharmaceuticals on the TV? And here it's like every second commercial during, you know, Olympics or Super Bowl.
Well, you know why that, you know what that is, though. I don't know if you've heard me talk about this, but that's basically money laundering.
I haven't heard you talk about it, but.
Well, let's make the last thing because I'm going to have to wrap up. But this is think about this for a second. They advertise on TV, you know, with these drugs, by the way, and the commercial format is always the same. It's some woman or old couple or man, you know, playing tennis with their grandchild. And then suddenly something's wrong and they grasp their chest and or their breath is bad or who knows what it is. They got heartburn or whatever. And then they talk about all the side effects in rapid fire speech about the bloody diarrhea and all the things you shouldn't be doing. And then they show the same person now playing frisbee or tennis with his grandson again, and everything is just great. That's the format. But the drug is a drug that you can't even pronounce. Look at the names of the drugs they give you. Do you think anyone's going to remember to go into their doctor's office and say, I want that bisbisvobitus drug? No, they're not going to remember that drug. And nobody goes into their doctor's office saying, tell me about that drug that I can't pronounce and I can't spell. No, what's happening here is that these drug companies are sponsoring these television shows, these news shows, these sports shows with advertising revenue, huge amounts of advertising revenue. You watch CNN and you watch every other commercial is about from a drug company. And then suddenly say there's a bad story about a drug. And the pharmaceutical company says to CNN, I'm picking on CNN, but says to CNN, if you run that story, we're going to pull out our advertising. Now, if you make 90% of your advertising from Big Pharma, you can't afford to have that happen. So you kill the story. It's the same thing with journals. Who pays for the journals? Pharmaceutical companies do. You think they're going to publish an article that's anti-pharmaceutical product in the journal? Very unlikely to do that. It happens once in a while. I don't know how, but it's really rare. So you have to find them in these international journals or these online journals. There's these public access journals because the main journals like the New England Journal of Medicine or Lancet are not going to publish articles that go against what their benefactor tells them they don't want. So by putting these things on, that's why it should be off television. It should be that it's influence peddling is what it is. And only the United States and New Zealand have it. Every other country in the world, you cannot advertise direct to consumer for drugs. I mean, we got rid of hard liquor advertisements. I mean, for a long time, I think they're back now, but for a while you couldn't advertise hard liquor. But I think I've seen like vodka commercials and.
I haven't had a TV in so many years. I don't know, but I did watch the Olympics a little bit here and there.
I'm just saying that there's no way that this television advertising, the way they do it, is to get somebody to go to their doctor and say, I want that unpronounceable drug and I want it now.
This has been incredibly illuminating and it's always such a pleasure to hang out with you. I feel like you're such a friend and we've never even met in person, but that's the age we're in, right? So I hope that soon I can make it out to Utah or we can connect somewhere. And
yeah, where are you again? I forgot.
In Miami.
Oh yeah, that's right. You're in Florida.
Yeah,
I forgot.
Yeah.
Oh, you're in Miami, not Fort Lauderdale.
Fort
right?
Lauderdale. Miami? Yeah. Fort Lauderdale. I've been in Miami for 14 years, from LA, you know, originally, but, Fort Lauderdale.
Well, come to one of my seminars, or if I ever get to Florida for one, I'll make sure that we hook up.
Of course. Thank you so much.
I love what I'm doing. I really love the fact that I now have really no masters. I can advocate for what I want. I'm still licensed in two states. I'm still a member of ACOG. You know, it's like the whole thing about that way I get their emails and I can see what they're doing. And sometimes it's really upsetting. I got one today that was rather upsetting. I can't pull it up because I can't use my clicker, but it keeps me engaged with them. But I think that we are making a change, whether it's one family at a time or one small group at a time or a bunch of midwives that are trained at a time. And the pressure will it will come to the organized medical community. They will eventually see that their product is no longer desirable anymore and they'll have to do something. And initially what they'll do is they'll push back. Because no tyrant ever just decided hang up their shoes and quit. You know, they always push back harder at first, but eventually they fail. And the system will fail. Unfortunately, I don't know it'll fail fast enough to save the next generation of women and children, but we'll see. We're trying.
Thank you so much for what you do every day, for all the women and families that you are supporting and educating, and you're changing lives. So thank you. Thank you so much. And I will share all of your info here in the show notes so people can listen to your podcast, follow you, get in touch with you, do your trainings, which I am still waiting to do, but I will soon, God willing. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye.